Dear colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, we are about to start this afternoon's session. This is going to be a series of Q&A sessions. Now, the idea behind this approach was to not only consider different disciplines in presentations, but to also have people talk with each other. Now, you're going to have a series of talks of 20 minutes each. You will always have one person who will ask questions and another person who will answer, and the person who has answered for 20 minutes will then ask questions to the next one. Now, at the entrance or on your seats, you find forms, and these forms can be used for the activation of the audience, if possible. In other words, if you have questions for the panelists, please enter them. We will collect these papers, and there will be 1 hour at the end of our afternoon session for a Q&A with the audience. Now, I would like to invite the first guest on stage, Ulrike Harms, and I'm going to ask questions. Now, briefly, Mrs. Harms. She is a musician. She played the violin for a long time. She's a doctor, a neurologist, and a neuroscientist at the Charité Hospital of Berlin. She's also a psychoanalyst. She is about to end her studies. So my first question is simple. Where in your professional practice have you encountered guilt and a feeling of guilt? And how? Well, thank you. Thank you for the introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, when I prepared this interesting round of talks, I wondered what could a neurologist, a neuroscientist contribute? And I tried to opt for the very neuroscientific approach. So I thought about neurophysiological processes. I looked at the brain. Are there certain aspects we could mention with respect to effects? The memory, cognition, and I have found a bit of literature about it. High-ranking and eminent scientists have published books about these issues. Now, I read all it, but then I realized something is missing here. And here, psychoanalysis helps me, because psychoanalysis goes and says, maybe what is missing matters. And eventually, yesterday, I realized what is missing here. Now, yesterday, we talked about corruption and that life is getting extremely difficult. Mr. Eigen talked about Transparency International, and he went into detail, and that was interesting. So I thought I should focus on my work, and since I am a neurologist, I thought it would not make sense to not talk about the medical dimension of guilt. I mean, I am immediately involved and I have to face guilt each and every day, because there is the possibility of becoming guilty. Being a doctor means you might make mistakes, and there's also corruption. So the health system is actually full of triggers. And I'm also from a family that has focused very much on guilt and the medical profession. Now, that was my approach. I thought I should consider guilt in the context of my profession. And the question is, what does it mean if you don't consider it. It's called a neglect in neurosciences or displacement in psychoanalysis. Now, first of all, you have to bear in mind that selective attention is healthy, is a natural aspect of the human physiology. You begin to filter, because otherwise you'd get afraid, you'd feel fear. And we talk about guilt, and we've just heard that guilt also involves fear. As Mr. Beaumont said, both go hand in hand, because you are afraid to make a mistake, for example, and that's omnipresent in psychology. We fear that the repertoire we provide of and the instincts we have cannot be controlled. And this is extremely complex. And I mean, what about the experience of guilt? And what about the feeling of guilt? Because guilt and the feeling of guilt also go hand in hand. And there is also the feeling of shame. To feel ashamed and to feel embarrassed, as we just heard in the presentation given by Mr. Beaumont, are closely connected. Now, what does this mean for me as a doctor, as a member of the medical profession? There are certain limits, and I should not transcend them. I should not go beyond. I have to respect them. Otherwise, I might become guilty, or I might trigger the feeling of guiltiness or shame. There are lots of things we tend to ignore, consciously ignore, because we are afraid, we feel fear. But this means that they don't become less true for this very reason. They are still true. So we have to focus on the feeling of guilt, I'd say, in order to cope with a problem. Now, fear, shame, guilt makes me ask you, how does fear become guilt, or the feeling of guilt, guiltiness? Now, people are afraid of guilt. The fear of guilt is also a concept in psychoanalysis. But then, of course, you are hampered and limited by the fear you feel. You can't act, you can't take a decision. And this is once again where we see that the two feelings are one and the same. Right. But then if it's about the fear of guilt, guiltiness is a reason for fear, but fear can also be a reason for guilt. What does it mean? Now, you don't want to be guilty. You don't want to become guilty. Guilt is actually the framework, first of all. Guilt is a moral framework that accompanies or has accompanied the human species from day one. We heard about Adam and Eve yesterday. Hunter Beaumont said that guilt triggers action. And guiltiness is different, but I'm not sure whether I agree. The fear of becoming guilty hinders. Now, but couldn't we go and say that guilt is also a coping strategy if you have to cope with fear? I mean, the concepts of guilt could show that guilt is an answer to fear. Now, I'm still looking at my profession, and I would like to mention two concepts. On the one hand, there is guiltiness, i.e., there is a clear reference. You have become guilty and you clearly know it. And then there is a vague feeling of guiltiness, which is not having a clear reference, which cannot be connected to a particular event. And here psychoanalysis comes in once again, because there are fears, it says in psychoanalysis, below the surface. And the guiltiness can help you mitigate fear or a guilt, which is behind the guiltiness, so to speak. Right, you've opted for the psychoanalytic perspective. But what about your medical practice? What about neurology and guilt? I mean, is this just about mistakes made by the doctor? Now, I think, of course, every doctor is afraid of making mistakes. With respect to the patient, it's less direct. So it's not about medical malpractice here, but this is about people who suffer and who maybe support their families, but now they are sick and they try to help their families nevertheless, which is difficult for the doctor to understand because the person who needs support is granting support. Right. This is like switching roles. Yes. Well, at least you have to be aware of the fact that these roles exist. Now, in our briefing, we considered one aspect which is to be seen in the context of your medical practice and in the context of guilt. You said that you grew up in the former DDR, i.e. in East Germany. Now, my question would be, how did they deal with guilt in the DDR? Well, that's interesting. And I guess we have to shift the focus a bit. We haven't talked about economics so far, but we should look at the money side now. And here I refer to the experiences I have had in the DDR as compared to West Germany. Money in East Germany had a different value from what we know today. Also, bonding via money was a different process. I mean, there was money, we had money, but there was nothing to buy with it. The economic system was much more based on a barter tradition. I mean, yesterday, someone said that barter is about close links and about deep relations. Now, you have this exchange, you have a kind of barter trade. You get something and you give something else, and then you're even if you pay with money. But it's very different when you go and say, okay, I want to have this or that from you, and I can offer any activity. I mean, the bonds do exist for a much longer period. Now, after the wall fell, I moved to Hanover, where I live for quite some time. And the feeling of asymmetry was less pertinent when money was involved. So I had the feeling of, well, okay, people have money and they pay for what they want to get. They get a bill, they pay for it, and then they are even. It was not a prolonged relationship. Right. That's interesting. I mean, in a system based on exchange or barter, you have people who are bricklayers, for example, who need a service done by a chimney sweeper, for example, so they just swap. But the system as such also requires a lot of knowledge. In other words, you had to know quite a bit about others in order to be able to swap, first of all. Now, we thought that East Germany, the DDR, was very much based on mistrust, that mistrust was a pertinent, an eminent, an omnipresent feeling. Now, if you see the whole system under the perspective of an exchange, would you say that it was at stake? Now, your question makes me think that you are right to a certain extent. Of course, there was mistrust, and that's what we learned from day one when we were children already. But then you also adopted nonverbal communication strategies. And at an early stage already, you knew whom you could trust and whom you should not trust. I mean, sometimes you thought you were friends with someone, but then you realized that you'd been wrong. But there was, all in all, an external form of frame, and inside of this external frame, there was an internal system at work, i.e. there were people you trusted, and this relationship of trust was based on non-verbal communication. Now, afterwards, when people considered all these Stasi cases, many realized that what they had considered friendships or those they had considered friends had not been friends, which was a shocking experience because they had trusted another person completely. And this was a big, big disappointment for them.
Zu studieren begonnen und den Beruf ergriffen. Wie hat sich diese Situation dann...
After the wall fell, what changed in your life, what has changed since then? Now, not much has changed in my life, actually. I mean, talking about my inner self. Because a lot of what I had learned with my students and at university, I could use for my everyday life and my medical profession also with respect to the doctor-patient relationship. And I could also benefit from what I had learned when I studied psychoanalysis. I mean, once again, talking about guilt and guiltiness, and that's why I wanted to describe it in extenso at the beginning of my answer, that it's very important to not ignore guilt and guiltiness. But then if you can incorporate bonds and guiltiness and guilt into relations, you will be much stronger. I mean, you will always overlook things, you will always ignore things. But yesterday, for example, in the talk, you talked about anonymity and abstraction. And if you now consider the medical or the psychoanalytic context, you realize that we are kind of moving away from the human being. A horrible term came to my mind when I thought about this topic last. It's the door to needle time. Now, this is about quality, and this is about the procedure in an emergency room. So how long does it take to get a patient from the door to the needle? It's called the door-to-needle time, and this is a concept I consider problematic, to say the least or difficult. Door to needle time is the time you have to keep as short as possible in order to treat a patient as soon as you can, a patient with a stroke or whatever. Yeah, but you could also call it patient to doctor time, but it's called door to needle time. Well, we have also reached the end of the door to needle time, and there's going to be a new panelist up here. I would like to thank you for your talks.